Were you allowed to eat in labor? What about drink? Or were you told that you could only have ice chips? The answers to these questions that I get are so vastly different, and that's because in the United States especially, there's no true standard of care that's followed surrounding the diet and labor. Today we're going to talk about the evidence that's out there, why some people recommend to not eat in labor, so that you can make an informed choice for yourself. Hey friends, my name is Emily, and I'm your birth advocate. I'm a labor and delivery nurse that has a passion for helping birthers advocate for themselves against the toxic cultures of labor. I teach you the most up-to-date research surrounding pregnancy and birth, give you tips and tricks I have learned in my profession, and empower you to take back your rights as a birther. So welcome. Keep listening for authentic tips and evidence-based information you can count on. This is your Birth Advocate, the podcast. Hey friends, I hope that you guys are having a great week, and thank you for tuning into the podcast for another week. Last week was so exciting with the launch. Everyone was so supportive, and I know 4 episodes is a lot to watch in 1 week, but from here on out, we're just going to have 1 podcast a week, so it won't be so heavy. Honestly, this is the 3rd time I've recorded this podcast, full transparency. The first time I was getting interrupted by my kids a lot. They were running around, making it very hard to record. The second time I did almost the whole thing and then realized that I wasn't actually recording. So that was a bummer. And now we're here we are at 10:30 at night going for the 3rd time. Just a little behind the scenes in amateur podcasting for you. So today I wanted to kick off, you know, the new weekly schedule of 1 podcast, talking about something that I think is most polarizing every time I post about it. Whenever I post about diets in labor, I get so much reaction. People are very emotionally charged on this topic, and rightfully so. And so I thought it was a great place to start because honestly, the research is a little confusing. The history is a little confusing, and there's a lot of it. And when I sat down to do the research for this podcast, I was really overwhelmed. So I can't even imagine what you guys feel when you sit down to try to do research. So that's where we're going to start, talking about eating in labor. First, I just want to talk about what is the risk. So why are providers so interested in what we put in our mouth during labor? And what everyone is super concerned about is aspiration. Aspiration is when liquids or solids are like basically thrown up and then they go back down your trachea and into your lungs, and it can cause lots of complications. It can be fatal. It's hard to recover from in some circumstances. So it is a risk and it's a scary one. So rightfully so, there is some worry surrounding it. Now, in pregnancy, this risk is when you have a C-section, specifically when you have a C-section under general anesthesia. Either you didn't have an epidural and you needed a C-section and it was emergent, or your epidural wasn't working properly and you needed an emergency C-section. There was some sort of major complication and they had to convert to general anesthesia, but this risk of aspiration is only when you have a C-section. When you're in labor and if you continue on and deliver vaginally, the risk is not there. There are a couple things that put you at an increased risk in pregnancy for aspiration if you were to go under general anesthesia. So this information is directly from the American Society of Anesthesiologists. And it says that factors that increase a laboring patient's risk of aspiration, which outweigh the risks of holding nutrition, are eclampsia, preeclampsia, obesity, and the use of opioids to manage pain, which delays stomach emptying. So according to them, those are the things that put you at risk during your pregnancy and during labor for aspiration. But on top of that, just being pregnant does change your body in a way that can increase the risk for aspiration. One of the main things is that when you're pregnant, there are a couple things that make you harder to intubate. Obviously, when you're pregnant, you have an increased body mass, and also you have enlarged breasts usually. These factors can make it hard to intubate in the correct way. A couple other things is that pregnancy and labor tend to decrease the rate of gastric emptying, which leaves more content in your stomach for longer, which increases your risk for aspiration. And additionally, with your uterus taking up so much space in your abdomen, your stomach is pushed up, everything in there is pushed up, and that makes the distance shorter for aspiration. So it's not that the risk of aspiration isn't there, it's just that the research today doesn't really follow the recommendations that are currently out there, especially in the United States. So next, we're gonna go behind the history of not eating in labor, and when this came about, when did the recommendation start, and why has it been bought into so much? So basically, in the 1940s, a man named Curtis Mendelson audited 44,000 pregnancies. In those 44,000 pregnancies, 66 of them suffered pulmonary aspiration. And furthermore, of those 66, 45 of the cases cited what they aspirated. So 40 aspirated liquid and 5 aspirated solid foods. And of the entire 66 pregnancies, 2 birthers died from the pulmonary aspiration complication, which if you do the math of 44,000 pregnancies and 66 women suffering pulmonary aspiration, that's already less than a percent rate that birthers got pulmonary aspiration. And then when you break it further down to the death rate, that's an even less chance. But nonetheless, based on his recommendation that this is an avoidable risk, and we should stop allowing birthers to eat and drink in labor, that kind of became the standard after that. So 1940s, this is when this started. What really attributed to the buy-in of this and why so many providers latched onto this, and probably why they have continued to latch onto this, is because after the 1940s, specifically the 70s and further, deaths during labor decreased significantly from anesthesia. So the trend was really going to anesthesia being less risky for birthers. And they attributed this to them not allowing food and drink in labor. But there was a lot of other things that this could be attributed to. Anesthesia got much more efficient, much better. They began intubating faster with better drugs. They began using cricoid pressure to make sure that the tube went into the right location. In addition, regional anesthesia became more popular, so epidurals and spinals, so that not every birther who needed a C-section got general anesthesia. So with this, yes, rates did get better after they started implementing this, but there was a lot of other things developing that could have been attributed. But since things did get better, the buy-in was really high for this no drinking or eating in labor. Since then, things have improved a bit in the United States. The American Society for Anesthesiologists no longer recommend ice chips or nothing by mouth. They now recommend clear liquids for low-risk labors. If C-section seems like it may be imminent due to fetal heart rate status, or they recommend 2 hours of nothing by mouth. This is all to say that I know there's still a lot of hospitals out there that are recommending ice chips only in labor. And if you're at one of those hospitals, I want you to pull up the ASA's recommendation and show it to them, because if the American Society for Anesthesiologists is disputing what they say, I don't feel like they have a leg to stand on unless they can explain to you why they believe you're at higher risk. Everything that I talk about today and every bit of research that I have, I'm going to be linking the articles and where I got it down in the description of the podcast. So this will also be linked in the description of the podcast. So I want to be really clear that throughout this rest of this podcast, where we really start to get into the nitty-gritty of the research, we are not talking about drinking labor. Clear liquids in labor, already been cleared, even by the United States, which, man, we're behind the times. But even by the United States, drinking clear liquids in labor has been cleared. So I want you to use that as your defense. So as we get into this, and as I just kind of alluded that the United States being behind the times, I think it's important to look at the different countries and what their practices are and try to use that in our judgment to make a decision. And you're going to see a theme throughout here of the United States doing it vastly different than any other country. So we'll just get started. So first, let's just talk about where the United States stands and the recommendations of the different organizations in the United States. So in a survey in 2008, fewer than 10% of hospitals had policies permitting food intake during the latent phase of labor. So latent phase of labor is the earlier stages of labor. And none permitted food intake during active phase. So that's kind of where we're standing. And that was in 2008, so it's a little bit old data, but I'm certain that numbers are still pretty similar. 10% allowed food intake in the early phases of labor, and none allowed food during the active phases. In the United States, we already talked about how the American Society of Anesthesiologists recommends clear liquids in labor. The American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists also recommend intake of clear liquids in labor. The American College of Nurse Midwives recommends that women at low risk for aspiration be able to determine themselves what their food intake, and just urges midwives to participate in research to confirm that they are low risk and safe for ad lib nutrition in labor. Now, furthermore, the World Health Organization, so we're kind of moving outside of the United States, recommends that we should not interfere with the women's desire for oral intake during labor. So you kind of have the United States, where most of our, you know, provider governing bodies are recommending clear liquids, except for the midwives. And then you have the World Organization recommending the complete opposite, basically, of what the United States is recommending, that they should be able to. And I just want to quick make a disclaimer that in my talking on this topic, if you hear me say woman, maternal, mother versus my normal inclusive language of birther, birthing person, etc., it's because I'm reading off of these research studies, and so I'm just not that good yet. I'm aiming to be that good, but as I'm reading woman, I'm just saying woman, so I apologize ahead of time. Just know that everyone is safe here. This is an inclusive podcast, but I'm just reading off of research articles that have that kind of verbiage. So anyway, sorry. Back to the research. So it's already been established in the United States, not very many people allow you to have food. So we're going to look outside of the United States and see the surveys and the studies that were done in different areas. In 2004, there was a survey of Australian maternity units, and 81%, a little over 81% of hospitals did not have a policy for oral intake in labor, which means that they didn't dictate what they put in their mouth. And a little over 18% of the policies varied from permitting ice chips only to giving them the freedom to eat and drink whenever they desired. And 60% of the hospitals reported that they leave food and fluid requirements to the woman's own discretion as long as they demonstrate no risk for general anesthesia. Australia lets you eat. Another survey of Dutch obstetricians and midwives said that 73% of OBs and 67% of midwives left the decision to eat or drink up to the woman. So again, Dutch OBs and midwives let their birthers eat. Furthermore, survey of British OB units found that 96% of units permitted oral intake, with only 32.8% allowing both fluids and food. So even better than the United States. So if you're seeing a trend here of everywhere but the United States allowing birthers to eat in labor. Now, I was able to look up the NHS, which is like the healthcare for the UK, basically, to just kind of make it short and sweet. Their guideline for eating and drinking in labor, essentially, all birthers can drink clear fluids and eat a light diet throughout labor unless they risk into one of these things: a body mass index over 40, multiple pregnancies, so twins or triplets, or, you know, more than one baby in there, breech presentation, Pitocin for augmentation, meconium staining of the fluid, and some women with epidural anesthesia. So while they seem to be a little bit more strict than other countries that we talked about with more of the high 70s, 80s range of letting birthers eat, they still have a policy and it still lets majority of their birthers eat unless they risk into one of these categories. So essentially, this isn't an all-inclusive list of all the countries in the world and who lets them eat and who doesn't. But I just wanted you to see a pattern here of if you live in the United States, it's going to be way less common that your provider is supportive of you eating in labor. And also, it's just an intriguing conversation, right? Like, why is it that birthers in other countries have so much more freedom to eat in labor, but in the United States, it's not safe? I find it strange that if it wasn't safe, it's done so freely in other areas and not in the United States. Especially when you start to look at our mortality rates compared to other first world countries. It just begs the question, why? And it's like this for a lot of birth topics, to be honest. A lot of birth topics we are more strict about and other first world countries are not. It's a common theme in pregnancy and labor healthcare throughout all kinds of topics. So when I really started doing the research and seeing what research is out there, I saw a couple common threads. All of the studies were very small. Most of them, maybe at most 4,000 pregnancies included. That's really not a big enough study to make a giant conclusion from. There was a lot of retrospective studies. So basically they looked back at information and gathered data and used that to come to their conclusion. That's an okay way to do research, but it's much better to be random and controlled in the study. So overall, just to be completely transparent, the research that I'm about to share with you is not great in terms of the research world. Now, in choosing these research articles, I tried to go with the biggest ones and the most current ones. I do have a couple in here that are on the older spectrum, but this is not all inclusive of the research that's out there on these topics. I just tried to pick the bigger studies because those are more accurate and the ones that are the most current, because again, that is most accurate if you listen to the third podcast fully, which I know a lot of you didn't because you don't want to do the research. You just want me to do it for you. No, I'm just kidding. But you always want to use big studies and studies that are the most current. And this podcast, up until right now and further with all the research, I'm just presenting it to you so that you can make an informed choice. Because the standard of care in the United States is not necessarily what's representative of the evidence and the standard of care in other countries, it's hard to make a choice and I can't necessarily make a recommendation. What I can do is give you the research and let you decide for yourself. So that's my disclaimer. This is where I'm coming from. Now, when we look at eating and labor, we can kind of break it up into three different areas. There are more, but these are the three main topics. Things to consider and things to look into when you're talking about eating and labor. Obviously, number one, and the thing we're going to talk about the most, is maternal outcomes. So, i.e., if you aspirated, that would be poor maternal outcome. We want to look at the neonatal outcome, if there's a bad outcome for the baby. So that's the first one, outcomes of the birther and the baby. The second one that seems to come up a lot is labor duration. We want to talk about, does eating in labor shorten the duration of labor? Does it shorten how long you're going to be in labor? And the third is maternal satisfaction. Now, I can tell you without even looking at any research that if you let birthers eat in labor, the satisfaction is going to be higher. It's going to affect their mood. It's going to affect their mental game of labor. And I can tell you that just because when I don't eat, I'm hangry. Bottom line. It also is just another thing that they're taking away from you and taking the control out of your hands. And that just can get frustrating to a point. Like, I can't even feed myself at this point. So I didn't really pull, for the sake of time, any research articles on birther satisfaction, because I think we can all agree that birther satisfaction is higher when they allow you to eat. You may not want to eat, but it is higher when they allow you to eat or when they recommend you eat. So we will jump straight ahead to labor duration. Now, almost all of the studies I'm going to talk about have a component addressing labor duration. Most of the studies, full disclosure, say that it did not impact labor duration in the group that was able to eat or in the group that was not able to eat. Most of them say it doesn't really impact labor duration. It doesn't really make it faster. There was one study though, and it is actually the most recent study in 2017 with around 4,000 birthers compared. So they compared eating in labor to a restricted diet, and overall there was 16 minutes less in labor duration for the group who ate. So altogether, I feel like Most studies cite that there's no difference in the duration. This study cites that there's a 16-minute difference, which I don't find to be significant, but if you do, you can take that into account. But altogether, I feel like labor duration is not super impacted by eating. This is all the research that I could find. So if anybody out there has any other research, feel free to send it to me and I can post it on my Instagram and my TikTok to update you guys. But this was all I could find. So kind of moving on to the big one, the one that makes all the decisions, is the outcomes of the birthers and the neonate. And I have 6 studies to cite on this. The first one is that same study about the labor duration. And in that one, not only did they find that it was 16 minutes less for labor, also no patients had aspiration. So of the 4,000, it didn't matter if they're on the eating side or the restricted side, no patients had aspiration. The next study was done in 2007 and it included 2,426. And again, there was no maternal or neonatal outcome difference between the group that was eating and the group that was not eating. Additionally, in 2014, the Cochrane Organization, which does a lot of systemic reviews, what a systemic review is, they look back and they gather all of the research studies that they can find and compare the results of all of them. So they did a review in 2014. And it included 3,130 low-risk pregnancies. And their conclusion was that evidence shows no benefit or harm to eating in labor for low-risk pregnancies. So there's no justification for the restriction. So basically they said, we can't really find a huge benefit, but we can't really find a huge harm either. So there's not really a reason to have a restriction anymore. Now, interestingly enough, in 2015, the American Society for Anesthesiologists had its annual meeting, and a group of researchers presented research that compared from 2005 to 2013, there was one case of aspiration with labor complicated by preeclampsia and obesity. And from their research, they concluded that they recommended a light meal for low-risk pregnancies. Now, even though they recommended a light meal for pregnancies, ultimately, the ASA decided not to change its recommendation. I find it interesting that a group of researchers did present this research to the ASA, and it was done not from an OB researcher's perspective or a midwife researcher's perspective, but it was done from anesthesiologist research. And lastly, because I did not want to make this seem like I'm one-sided at all, this is truly just the most recent and biggest studies that I could find, I wanted to include a research article from 1999, so it's the oldest of all of them. They did the same thing everyone else is doing, comparing eating to not eating. They cited that nobody in their study needed general anesthesia, but after delivery, they measured the amount of residual gastric volumes in the birthers. So basically they measured the stomach contents and they found that birthers in the eating group had a larger amount of residual gastric volumes. So they took this information and used it to recommend not eating in the active phase of labor. So I know I went through a bunch of studies and they all gave no maternal or neonatal difference in outcomes, whether you ate during labor or not. But this specific study did add that the gastric contents were higher in the birthers that ate, which makes sense because they were eating and the other people weren't. And from that decided that it wasn't safe to eat in active labor. So I wanted to add that because I think it's important to be well-rounded. And that was honestly one of the only studies that I could find that really said anything in the direction of not eating. Oh, and lastly, I have a study from 2018, and it had around 3,000 pregnancies included. It was a retrospective study, so, you know, it looked backwards, like we talked about earlier. And again, the results were that oral intake did not increase adverse maternal or neonatal outcomes, so more of the same. So I think it's important when you're looking at this information that you try to look at the discrepancies. So, you know, we have all these research articles, and there are more, that say that there was no risk to the birther or the baby when they ate versus when they didn't eat. And then you look at the fact that other countries allow their low-risk birthers to eat. And you're like, what do we know in the United States that no one else knows? It's just, it's kind of particular. And when you look at the discrepancy and you look at the research, I think it's clear that at the very least, it's not as black and white as some providers are making it in the United States. As always, I talk about the toolbox that you need to make a decision. You have to take into account what your providers are saying to you, what they're recommending, because they're on your team and they know you specifically and your care needs specifically. And you have to take what the research is saying, how other places do it. And then you also just have to look individually in yourself and think what is important to you in labor and what risks are you willing to take? Because aspiration, I mean, it's not a small risk, but you have to have all those things in your toolbox to make a decision. And in the research article that was presented at the annual meeting for the American Society of Anesthesiologists, they made a very distinct comment that I really liked. They said that providers should look at the individual risk factors of the person instead of as a whole. And honestly, I think that that is where obstetrical care falls short in a lot of ways, especially in the United States. They make these blanket recommendations for everyone when everyone is not the same. And most often, what works for someone does not work for another person. And that's in it. Everyday life in anything. And I really liked how they said, let's stop looking at people like they're no different from the next. And let's start looking at them individually and assessing their risks individually and then making decisions for them individually. And I really hope that that's where obstetric care goes in the future. But until then, we'll just keep putting the pieces into our toolbox and making decisions that are informed. All right, guys. So this week, we're not going to do a question of the week. I think that this podcast episode was really hefty, and I'm really aiming to keep all of my episodes between 20 and 30 minutes. So for the sake of time, we're going to skip the question of the week. But please message me and let me know, or write a review and let me know if you like the question of the week part of the podcast, and if I should keep it in. Thank you again, obviously, so much for listening to the podcast, supporting me. Please subscribe or follow the podcast. That helps me out so much. And follow me on Instagram and TikTok at Your Birth Advocate to get more content like this. And I hope you guys have a great week, and I'll see you next week.